Good morning, Cedar Ridge. My name is Allison Pasternak, and I am the treasurer here at Cedar Ridge. I had originally hoped to find a movie that aligned with my position as treasurer, so I was delighted when I found a movie called Tithes and Offerings. But then I learned that the movie is in Swahili, and since my knowledge of the Swahili language ends at Hakuna Matata, I aborted that plan. Instead, I will be discussing Remember the Titans. Although I'm not a huge football fan, or even a tiny football fan, I do love true stories. I'm far more inspired by the characters in a movie if I know they're based on real people. I especially love true stories about critical topics like racial justice. Remember the Titans fits that bill. It's a true story set in Alexandria, Virginia in 1971. Let's watch this first clip, which will provide key details about the movie's context and setting. As you may recall, the Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 held that racial segregation in public schools is unconstitutional. Nevertheless, 67 years after Brown versus Board of Education, public schools remain segregated. In fact, segregation is getting worse. A recent analysis of National Assessment of Educational Progress data by Emma Garcia at the Economic Policy Institute found that Black children are 5 times as likely as white children to attend schools that are highly segregated by race and ethnicity. And Black children are more than twice as likely as white children to attend high poverty schools. In terms of test scores and student outcomes, the best way to equalize schools is through integration. Segregation consigns most Black children to schools that put them behind academically. In addition to being chair of the board at Cedar Ridge, Melinda Anderson is also an acclaimed education journalist who has authored pieces for multiple news outlets. She's written 59 articles for The Atlantic, and I've read them all. Her first book was published in 2020. It's called Becoming a Teacher. The book is a portrait of Baltimore public school teacher Lakeisha Hall. In addition to describing the joys and challenges of teaching in Baltimore, Melinda examines broader themes, including educational inequity. On page 95, Melinda writes, "As a principal, every child in America has the right to a free K-12 education, regardless of race, class, gender, language, sexual orientation, or immigration status. In reality, the 51 million students enrolled in U.S. public schools receive wildly inequitable educations, with opportunities and outcomes directly linked to race, socioeconomic, and other demographic characteristics. The quality of public education is also highly influenced by where a child lives, a byproduct of funding schools with local tax dollars." New York City has one of the most segregated school systems in the country. A 5-episode podcast called Nice White Parents looks at the stark inequality in public education in New York City. In the podcast, Hannah Jaffe Walt says, "There's a powerful force that is shaping our public schools, arguably the most powerful force. If you want to understand why our schools aren't better, that's where you have to look. You have to look at white parents." She reveals how some white parents, even white parents who say they want integration and diversity, are actually obstacles to racial equity in schools. White parents either flee or hoard resources. White parents cordon off their children in special gifted programs or steamroll minority parents or dominate school board meetings, yet public schools are maniacally loyal to white families, Jaffe Walt says. Just the very idea of us, the threat of our displeasure, warps the whole system. So separate is still not equal because the power sits with white parents. Racial segregation isn't biblical. One of my favorite Bible passages is the story of the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25. Regardless of which movie I picked for this message, I'm sure I would have found a reason to mention this passage. In the story of the sheep and the goats, the Son of Man separates people based on how they treat the hungry, the thirsty, the stranger, someone needing clothes, someone who's sick or a prisoner. Nowhere in the passage does Jesus say that people will be separated by race or ethnicity. For that matter, nowhere in the passage does Jesus say that people will be separated by sexual orientation or gender identity or place of birth or bad taste in music. We will be judged by the choices of our hearts, not the color of our skin. For God doesn't favor one race or ethnicity over another. My younger daughter, Courtney, is going to read Acts 10, 34 to 35, the Message version.
Peter fairly exploded with his good news. It's God's own truth. Nothing could be plainer. God plays no favorites. It makes no difference who you are or where you're from. If you want God and are ready to do as he says, the door is open.
Back to the movie. Shortly after the introductory clip that we watched earlier, the Board of Education tries to calm racial tensions by making the Black coach the head coach at T.C. Williams. Coach Boone and his family are new to town. They just moved from North Carolina, where Coach Boone was a successful coach. The white coach, Coach Yost, begrudgingly agrees to stay on the coaching staff when the white players refuse to play if Coach Yost leaves. Before the season starts, the team goes to football camp at Gettysburg College for 2 weeks. Things get off to a rocky start. Fist fights, anger, aggression. Coach Boone forces the players to spend time each day getting to know a teammate of a different race. Until they meet every teammate, there will be 3 practices per day. When Coach Boone pushes the players to the point of exhaustion, Coach Yost warns him, there's a fine line between tough and crazy, and you're flirting with it. This next clip is the turning point in the movie. After this scene, the team begins to bond. They bond over mama jokes and other locker room banter. During their meals, they start sitting together by position rather than by race. The atmosphere on the bus ride home from camp is the polar opposite of the atmosphere on the way to camp. But they're forced back into the real world on the first day of school when Black students and white students will attend classes together for the first time. Tensions are high. People are waving signs outside the school. The signs read, Alexandria parents against busing, and we love our kids, we hate busing. Coach Boone learns that the Board of Education didn't expect him to make it out of football camp. They thought he would have quit by now and they could replace him with Coach Yost. But since Coach Boone made it past football camp, he'll be fired as soon as the team loses a game. Coach Boone is so nervous that he vomits before the first game. Like all the other teams in the conference, the opposing team is white. The Titans unite and they win their first game. After the game, the Black players face prejudice and discrimination as they celebrate in town. 2 Black players get kicked out of a restaurant, and Gary, the white captain, faces resistance from his girlfriend and mother as his friendship with Julius grows. The Titans go on to win their second game. Coach Boone and Coach Yost come to like and respect each other. While Coach Yost's daughter, Cheryl, is at the Boone's house, someone throws a brick through the Boone's window. Coach Boone refuses to be intimidated. Coach Yost urges him to stop antagonizing everybody and learn some humility. Coach Yost says, if you want to carry your sinful pride with you to your grave, that's your business. But when your sins endanger my little girl, it becomes mine. Coach Boone responds, my sins? You think my sins have something to do with what happened last night? I'm sorry about what happened to your daughter. I really am. But maybe you got a small taste of what my girls go through. Welcome to my life, Yost. During the third game, the other team deliberately injures the Black quarterback nicknamed Rev. His wrist is broken, so he is unable to play quarterback for the remainder of the season. A white hippie nicknamed Sunshine takes over as quarterback. The Titans win the third game. After the game, Gary asks Coach Boone to remove a white player named Ray from the team because Ray intentionally missed the block that led to Rev's injury. Gary and Julius grow closer. Julius visits Gary in his white neighborhood, and Gary's mom starts to bond with Julius as well. The Titans go on to have an undefeated season, which thrills the entire town except the white members of the school board. At the regional championship game, the referees clearly favor the other team. Coach Yost surmises that the board members rigged the game so that the other team would win, and then Coach Boone would be fired. Coach Yost would be reinstated as head coach, and Coach Yost would be inducted into the Virginia High School Hall of Fame. The game fixing reminds me of a point that professor and author Ibram X. Kendi made in a speech at a 2018 CAP conference. Dr. Kendi said, when there are disparities between groups, the only 2 causes are unequal groups or unequal policies governing the equal groups. A few years ago, one of my white neighbors insisted that there's no racial discrimination in employment because it makes financial sense for employers to hire the most qualified person for a job. Well, as an economist, I can say that the data don't lie. Persistent racial disparities exist in employment, wages, benefits, and almost every other measure of economic well-being, even after controlling for experience, education, occupation, and industry. So persistent employment disparities reflect discrimination and unequal policies, just as the refs imposed unequal policies during the regional championship game. Coach Yost is not okay with that. He approaches one of the referees and threatens to go to the papers with a story about the game fixing unless the refs call the game fairly. The refs adjust their unequal policies and the Titans win the regional championship. As a result, Coach Yost is not inducted into the Hall of Fame. Instead, he becomes a main character in a Disney movie 30 years later. The next clip occurs just after the regional championship. For those who haven't seen the movie and don't like to be startled, I want to warn you that there will be a crash in this scene. The brotherly love in this scene is beautiful. Jesus commanded us to love our neighbor as ourselves. My older daughter, Jenna, will read John 13, 34 to 35 for us.
A new command I give you. Love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another.
The Bible also teaches us to treat people equitably. Here's another one of my favorite Bible verses.
And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God.
The Hebrew word for justice is mishpat. Its most basic meaning is to treat people equitably. Throughout the Old Testament, mishpat refers to taking up the cause of widows and orphans, the poor and vulnerable. God instructs us to care for those with the least economic and social power. As my friend Willie Flowers says, the conversation about equity and inclusion without resources to go with it means nothing. I met Willie at a Black Lives Matter rally in Columbia several years ago. We've been running together off and on since then. Although we have different ideas about good running weather since he's from Alabama and I'm from Connecticut. Here's a picture of three of us pausing on our way up a dreadful hill in Ellicott City. Willie is the president of the NAACP Maryland State Conference and president of the NAACP branch in Howard County. I interviewed Willie for this message.
So first, please tell us a little about your story. I already mentioned that you grew up in Alabama. So please tell us about your childhood, why you moved to DC and then Maryland, and why you chose to run for president of the NAACP branch in Howard County and then the NAACP Maryland State Conference.
Well, I'm like I said, I'm from Alabama, and I was grew up in a an African American community, a family, small community. I was very connected to my church, the AME tradition, kind of breathes service into everything that we do, and support for community. So I kind of was, you know, I guess groomed toward community uplift. And my first experience with any injustice, I didn't learn to be angry about it. I learned to do something about it because of service. I think I do believe that if you have a mind for service and self-determination, which is another tenet of our community that I grew up in, to be self-determined and independent, that you don't, you know, you can get angry. Of course, you don't want to be pushed over or anything if there's injustice, but I think injustice is a gateway to fulfilling what justice is. So letting justice dominate, and you know, you, again, you can be angry, but you're angry and stressed so that you can resolve the issue, and that way your anger is resolved and stress is resolved. So that's kind of the kind of mentality I grew up in. Now, when you get into these larger political things, they believe in anger. They believe in all that. I mean, I'm growing not to appreciate any of that because I think it causes challenges that are not substantial. It doesn't deal with substance of the issue. It deals with personality, deals with politics. And so I have grown to try to work towards solutions And again, it goes back to what I think service is, that you're serving not to heal, you know, to deal with yourself, you're serving to make the community better. So in the space I grew up in, that's what I learned in my community. Now, when this thing about, you know, the social construct of race and the what that means comes into it, it's a barrier. And I've learned this is a barrier to overcome. And so I was drawn to trying to find solutions in any case. And the solution I thought was politics. Not that I don't believe that now, but I do believe that the start of changing these political systems is changing, you know, who we are, you know. So, and that's from a Christian perspective. And so if we are better human beings, then we can work better to heal these systems. But back to the question, that's what I kind of grew up in. I was attracted to, I was actually attracted to writing and media, which led me to seeing that the mayor, for example, of my town was the solution for policies and this kind of thing. So I was attracted to politics because of that. And, but I was more importantly, my first heroes were civil rights leaders. So I wanted to be a civil rights leader because they seemed to be the people who drove things, Dr. King, you know, Malcolm X, anybody doing anything to fight injustice. I thought they were the players, and I wanted to do that. But when I grew up in this little town and went to college, when I got to college, there was no applications for civil rights leaders. So, and that time from 1992, and I finished in 1994, the biggest thing happening in regard to people who appeared to be doing things at the national policy level were, you know, politicians. So I wanted to play in that space, and that's how I got to DC. And during college, I, you know, did SGA. I did pretty much anything you could do to maximize my interest to feed my fancy at that level. But I thought the true solution was in Washington, D.C., and that's why I moved there.
I'll show another clip from the interview a little later. For now, I want to underline the following statement that Willie made. The start of changing these political systems is changing who we are. If we are better human beings, then we can work better to heal these systems. At Cedar Ridge, we talk a lot about racial justice. We acknowledge that racism is pervasive and systemic. White supremacy is so destructive that we need to continually consider and reconsider its impacts. As Ibram X. Kendi eloquently explained in his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, it's not enough to declare that we are not racist, because the opposite of racist isn't not racist. The opposite of racist is anti-racist. We must choose whether to be racist or anti-racist, and we need to keep making that choice hour after hour, day after day. Dr. Kendi draws an analogy between anti-racism and fighting an addiction. Like fighting an addiction, being an anti-racist requires persistent self-awareness, constant self-criticism, and regular self-examination. Numerous articles, books, and social media posts have listed ways to fight racism. Ruth insisted that this cannot be a two-hour message, so I've narrowed down my list from 12 ways to 5 ways. Number 1, educate yourself. Read articles and books on racism, discrimination, and privilege. Listen to podcasts, watch documentaries and films. Immerse yourself in Black history. Read up on influential Asian Americans. Learn about Hispanic Americans who changed the world. Listen with compassion to people who experience racism daily. Imagine yourself in their shoes. Number 2, raise awareness. Share what you've learned about racism, discrimination, and privilege with your family and friends. Convince them that racism did not end when Barack Obama was elected president. Until recently, many people were not aware of the racism experienced by Asian Americans. Spread the word. Here's another clip from my interview with Willie Flowers.
So talking about, you know, having these, they call them courageous conversations with the same old people, gets us nowhere, you know, because, and getting to the conversation about the allies, the, you know, those terms, you know, good terms and all that, I guess you give somebody space. But the reality is, until other white people tell white people, like, this is what's wrong. Like, it's the case that I see that white people don't bring other white people to the table, you know, who need to know this stuff. So that's the other challenge.
Let's speak up, white people. Number three, engage in political action. Participate in protests, sign petitions, call elected officials, and attend Black Lives Matter rallies. For the past 4 years, I've been attending monthly Black Lives Matter rallies organized by the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Columbia. Sometimes my daughters come with me. The rallies are held on the second Sunday of every month for 1 hour, 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock, near the Columbia Mall. Join us anytime. Number four, support minority-owned businesses. Find local minority-owned businesses and frequent them. Support minority-owned restaurants, bookstores, tech companies, designers, and artists. For example, I ordered a large box of Latour Tish toilet paper after reading an article about this Black-owned and woman-owned company in Baltimore. And bonus, the toilet paper is environmentally friendly. It's made from bamboo. Number five, donate to civil rights organizations. Donate to the NAACP. Did you know that the NAACP welcomes white members? I have a lifetime membership. Another great civil rights organization is the Equal Justice Initiative, which works to end mass incarceration and excessive punishment. My eyes were opened to the mass incarceration crisis when I read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. As a Cedar Ridge treasurer, I would be remiss if I didn't encourage such donations after your tithes and offerings to Cedar Ridge. Back to the movie. As the team mourns Gary's injury, the Titans move on to the state championship. Gary's mom receives a standing ovation as she enters the stands. Meaningfully, she hugs and then sits down with Coach Boone's wife, having overcome her racial prejudices. At halftime, the Titans are trailing by 7 points. Several people give moving speeches in the locker room. In the second half, the coaches make some strategic changes and the Titans' performance improves. Then, for the very last play, Coach Poon brings in the injured quarterback Rev for a trick play, and the Titans win the state championship. Here's the final movie clip. Yes, we will always remember the Titans. However, the name of T.C. Williams High School will change on July 1st due to the segregationist views held by its namesake. Thomas Chambliss Williams served as superintendent of Alexandria City Public Schools from the 1930s to the 1960s. T.C. Williams resisted integration, arguing that Black and white students learn differently. Efforts to rename the high school failed multiple times over the past three decades, partly because some opponents of the switch argued that keeping the name T.C. Williams would help the students get into better colleges due to the prestige of the movie and Denzel Washington's fame. Finally, last month on April 8th, the school board voted to rename the school Alexandria City High School. One of my coworkers' children attended T.C. Williams High. I discussed the renaming controversy with his daughter, Alex, who is a 2020 graduate of T.C. Williams High.
How did you first learn about T.C. Williams? Like, what grade were you and how old were you when you first learned who he was?
Oh, who he was?
Yes.
Oh, I want to say I was, like, a junior in high school.
Okay.
Like, I had no, like, I remember, like, middle school and even, like, freshman year, like, all my friends would be, like, who is, like, we had no idea who he was or, like, anything like that. And I think it was until, like, my history class where we, like, asked my teacher, like, who is T.C. And, like, he was, like, Thomas Chandler, and my teacher, like, told us like everything, and we're like, oh, okay, cool.
Right. Yeah. So do you support renaming, or did you support renaming TC Williams High?
I have mixed like emotions about it. I mean, obviously I don't want my high school to be changed, and I understand that, like, I understand why they did it, and they can't like not rename it just because of like we have a movie and things like that, because like so many other high schools in my area, like their high schools are like changed too. But I don't know, there was this one interview with like someone from like Remember the Titans movie that was like actually like on the football team, and he was like, they shouldn't change your name because it's like he wanted like the high school to be segregated or whatever. But it's like, we're like, he said he were stomping like on his grave because our school is like so diverse. It's just like proving him wrong in like so many ways, which is like, in that point, it's like, don't change it. And it's like, I don't know, like our school is just like, because of like having a movie, it's just like our history so much, but like he was a bad dude, so it like should not have a something named after him. I think it was beneficial, and especially like in our time period, just to like where we are now, just like we're not just like letting him just like slide about what he did, like, oh, it's okay, like it's because we have like a movie and like who we are, like we're still allowed to say like that's right. So I think it is good that we did change it.
And you like the movie Remember the Titans?
Oh, I think it's so good. I remember in like middle school, they would play it like whenever we had a substitute teacher. So I got kind of like sick of it because I've seen it like 20 times. But no, I think it's really good.
As Alex said, we can't let the actions of bad dudes slide. After the conviction of Derek Chauvin, the police officer who murdered George Floyd, Dr. Kendi tweeted, "Now let's get us some justice, some systemic justice." I love that concept, systemic justice. We need to replace systemic racism in this country with systemic justice. Let's commit to that journey together.